Of course, as you know, there are many competing priorities for the government money. So it is very possible that we will once again have a cut in the federal money. The only place we can go to make up the difference, because, of course, the costs continue to go up, the only place we can go to make up the difference is to individuals like you who value the programs on this station. So if you are a supporter of WILL, we want to say thank you very much. And if not, now's the time for you to join up. You can call 244-9455, 217 is the area code, and make your pledge. You can pledge online at willpledge.org. So whichever way works for you, we hope that you will do that. Maybe it's one of those things that's on your mind and on your list of things to do, and you just haven't quite gotten to it yet. Well, why don't you do that right now, or at least this morning, during Focus 580. That would be great if we could hear from you. That pledge number again is 244-9455, or pledge online at willpledge.org. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, the second hour of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with a writer who's produced a novel that looks at an unusual and maybe unlikely friendship that existed between two men who, in their day, were world famous, two very, very well-known individuals. One of them, Conan Doyle, Arthur Conan Doyle, the man who created Sherlock Holmes. The other, Harry Houdini, known around the world for his magic and his escape arts. This was a relationship that was based on a kind of a mutual interest that both men had in spiritualism. It was the thing that brought them together, and eventually it was the thing that broke them apart. And it is the story, one of the stories, that Gabriel Brownstein tells in his new novel. It's titled The Man from Beyond, and it's published by W.W. Norton. It's just out recently. Gabriel Brownstein is author of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Apartment 3W, which is a collection of stories that received the Penn Hemingway Award, was also named one of the 25 books to remember of 2002 by the New York Public Library. He is a lifelong New Yorker. He now teaches at St. John's University in Queens and makes his home in Brooklyn. This is his first novel, Man from Beyond, and he's talking with us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome from people who are listening. If you want to participate in the conversation, you can do that. 333-9455 is the number to call. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good, anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. If you'd like to join in the conversation here, you can do that. Use those numbers. You'll come right here to the program. No one will expect you to make a pledge. That would be nice. We would like that, but it is not required if you want to call into the show. Well, Gabriel Brownstein, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We certainly appreciate it. It's a fascinating story, I think, the story of Conan Doyle and Houdini. It does seem a little improbable, at least in when you look at the attitudes that both of these men had to the subject. One, and we can talk about that a little more, but basically the fact that one really was a believer, was a true believer.
Right.
And while the other one, perhaps he wanted to believe, his attitude was very heavy skepticism.
Right.
And he said, okay, I'm willing to believe, but you got to prove it to me. And here was a guy that if anybody was going to know that somebody was working a scam, it would have been Harry Houdini. Maybe we could talk a little bit, or you could talk a little bit about spiritualism and about what in the this was a movement that had been, by the time that this story gets underway in the 20s, had been going for a while. What do you think for people of this time, the appeal of the idea of making contact with somebody who had died? Why did that have such great appeal?
Well, there are lots of different kinds of spiritualism, and it's spiritualism, is a very American thing in its history. Some of the early spiritualists were in the 1820s in upstate New York, but the kind of spiritualism that Conan Doyle was interested in was almost an intellectual pursuit. I mean, it's very difficult because to imagine this stuff, because it seems incredibly goofy. Conan Doyle fell for really obvious tricks. The Cottingley Fairies is a famous one. Mm-hmm. And these were essentially paper dolls that little girls had, and they posed next to these paper dolls of fairies and claimed that the pictures were pictures of actual fairies. And Conan Doyle believed it. And he believed in all sorts of things like that. And it's very difficult to believe in his intelligence, given that he believed these things, given his gullibility. But he was a brilliant man, and I think that's important. And I think it's important that a lot of people believed in spiritualism, believed in the connection with the beyond. The Society for Psychical Research was a really important intellectual organization. Its members included William James and Sigmund Freud. And so in certain ways, Conan Doyle came to this as an intellectual and as a humanist. He believed that spiritualism was a scientific religion that would unite everybody. Mm-hmm. He saw a world divided by racial and religious creeds, and he thought he could unite everyone around this mystical belief that through mediums, we could contact the beyond and we could understand our position in the spiritual universe as something in which we were all united. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense. I think, and yet at the same time, I suppose when you think about Conan Doyle and the literary character he created, Sherlock Holmes, it seems interesting that this man who was responsible for this literary creation, who is the man, the complete man of logic,
right,
would himself, in his personal life, have these interests that seem to defy logic.
Saw it as science. You see, spiritualists felt that they could measure and photograph these forces from beyond and scientifically prove that spirits existed, an afterlife existed. They felt it was science. Conan Doyle was also a political person. Really very much a good man. He campaigned very forcefully against the genocide in the Belgian Congo at the turn of the century. And he was an incredibly brave man. As a famous author, he put his life on the line and went to enlist in the Boer War because he, believed in the British Empire. He was willing, really, to risk life and reputation for all kinds of things. And he felt that he was doing good, that the greatest good he could do was in the quest to convince the world of that spiritualist belief was true. And, because he was so famous and because he was so personally powerful, he had incredible effect in these things. I mean, when he came to New York City in 1922 and spoke at Carnegie Hall about spiritualism, it was front page news in every single newspaper in the city. It was the place was packed. He was like the Beatles. He was one of the most famous men of his time, and he was impassioned on this subject.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he was wrong, and he was humiliated because he pursued these things so publicly. But I think from his point of view, it wouldn't be a conflict between Holmes and spiritualism. Spiritualism would be a kind of rationalism.
Let's talk about Houdini a little bit, because it's interesting that I gather that what attracted Houdini to Doyle was the fact that Houdini believed Doyle was an intelligent man, a rational man, and that he was approaching it in that way, and that was no doubt the way that Houdini thought about himself.
Well, one thing is Houdini liked famous people. He liked to be photographed with famous people. And he wanted to be close to famous people. And he liked Arthur Conan Doyle for a number of reasons. Apparently, Arthur Conan Doyle was a very likable man. Houdini saw him as gentlemanly and kind and brave and smart and all sorts of things. And Houdini had literary ambitions, too. Houdini had all kinds of ambitions. Houdini was also interested in religious questions. He thought of himself as an intellectual. He thought of these things as intellectual questions. But he had nothing but disdain for the sort of mystics that attracted Doyle, the sort of table-lifting, room-in-a-dark, ectoplasm-producing mystics that Conan Doyle was so drawn to. And what you said in your introduction is true. Houdini knew all their tricks. There was nothing they could do that he didn't understand. So you know, again, don't. It's important not to think of Doyle's belief as so eccentric. In 1922, when Doyle came to the city, to New York City, to speak, Scientific American magazine was running a contest to find a medium whose powers were real. It's sort of shocking to believe. And they gave a prize if they could find such a medium. And they did award their prize to the medium who plays some role in my novel, Marjorie. Marjorie declined the prize, but the magazine asserted that she was a genuine thing. Houdini was able to see through her, and it was that fight which destroyed the friendship between Houdini and Doyle. Doyle championed Marjorie. Okay. It's important that my novel is not a history, though. My novel is a fantasy built around these things. There are lots of good books that talk about these things, and I think my novel is sort of interesting in a way it draws you into this world. But it's important to remember it's not the real thing.
Yes, yeah. although a number of the events,
yeah,
in the novel, the things that you write about, particularly the things that involve Houdini and Conan Doyle, did indeed happen. You are,
yeah,
drawing on real events. And for example, one of the things that in the beginning, the book opens, and here is Conan Doyle and, yeah, his family, his wife and kids,
yeah,
and Houdini at the seashore, Atlantic,
yeah,
City. What an amazing image. Here he is, this man, this great man, the creative Sherlock Holmes. They're on the beach, and his kids are running around in the water, and here's Houdini.
Yeah.
He's fooling around, showing off. And you're thinking, well, that's just what, and who could even think of such a thing? Well, here I am reading along, trying to get a little basic background on these two men and their lives. And in fact, they did go to the beach. There are photographs here in one,
yes,
of the things I have. Here's a picture of Houdini and Conan Doyle and his wife and kids at the beach in Atlantic City. And you think,
it's shocking.
Yes.
Part of what's shocking to me about it is the historical, what seems to me this huge historical problem. Because, you know, Atlantic City in 1922, you know, there are radio shows, there's Miss America pageants, there are big hotels and automobiles, and, you know, it's modern American life. And,
mm-hmm,
and you think of Houdini, and you think of wacky sideshows of the 19th century, and you think of Conan Doyle, and you think of, you know, hansom cabs and horse-drawn carriages and foggy London nights, you know?
Mm.
And the idea of these people in, you know, the roaring 20s and how out of place they are, at least in my imagination, in that setting, was part of what drew me to it. And, you know, it was funny because what they did with this spiritualism debate, I think, to a large degree, was to make real the world of their imaginations. You know, I mean, here they were interested in mystery and magic, which are things that, as a writer, I'm really interested in, and they tried to sort of bring it to life.
Yeah.
You know, by having this debate about this medium, and. I don't know that they thought of it that way. I,
yeah,
think they thought they were pursuing really important intellectual questions of the time.
Well, it's, something else that I think is really interesting is the collision of psychology, spiritualism, technology, media, all in sort of meeting at this time when everything is sort of rough and new and not quite sure of itself. And and the thing, I think it's interesting if you think about the fact that here is a time when people are, modern communications technologies are in their infancy and people are just getting used to the idea. And that if you think about the fact that people are just getting used to the idea that, that I could be in New York and I could talk with somebody who was in California.
Right.
Over some sort of mysterious kind of system that I really don't quite understand. So where this person, halfway across the country, their voice is coming out of a little box in front of me. Is it really so odd, the idea that you could talk to somebody who had died and that it was a different kind of gulf and maybe a different kind of means of communication, but the, but is that is it really so hard to believe one and not to believe the other?
Well, it still persists. I mean, we have telephone psychics and television stars who will get you in touch with your dead relatives, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not all gone. But absolutely, I think you're absolutely right. I think that, when I would leaf through old copies of Scientific American magazine, in part looking for the articles that I was telling you about the search for the true mystic. But what kept on attracting me were the ads, and particularly the way that advertisements talked about radio, which is really, for me, was quite shockingly analogous to the way we talk about computers now. Radio was going to change the world, you know. Radio was going to make everything different, and it did. And there was one particular ad for Eveready batteries, which would be used to power radios, and it said, "The air is full of things you shouldn't miss." And it seemed like a direct analogy to mysticism.
Yeah.
You know? And there's a wonderful part of a William Maxwell novel, So Long, See You Tomorrow, where a character talks about how there are these songs in the air above him, and he's talking about radio, and his analogy is Caliban. In Shakespeare's The Tempest, hearing the songs in the air, you know, it's a wonderful part of the novel. But I thought about that while I was writing it, that way that technology seems magic, and it still does.
Yeah. We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Gabriel Brownstein. He is a professor of English. He teaches at St. John's University, which is in Queens, and makes his home in Brooklyn. And he's the author of a novel that's just come out recently. The title of the novel is The Man from Beyond, and it is published by Norton, W.W. Norton, and is in part about the interest in the time, this takes place in the 20s, in spiritualism, and also about the relationship, the friendship, and then how it went on the rocks, involving Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the British writer who created Sherlock Holmes, and Harry Houdini, the great magician and escape artist. And you can find the book in the bookstore right now, I'm sure, if you head out and take a look at it. And we also hear, maybe just, I need to take a second, a little bit of a break from a conversation, to remind people who are listening that this is a time that we are looking for support from the people who listen. It is not magic. Public radio is not magic. It relies on very concrete things like money and the support of people who listen. And so this is one of those times that we're asking people to reach into their pockets and to pull something out, to pull out some money and send it to us to make sure that this station that we know you rely on continues and stays strong. Let's check in here just for real quick for a minute or two with Rita Schulte. She is our membership director. She's in Pledge Central and can kind of tell us how we're doing here. Is that we're past the midpoint, so but we need to maintain our momentum if we're going to carry through and make that big goal, that $160,000 goal that we have set for ourselves.
That's right, because money turns into programs here at WILL. It's a simple equation. And part of that equation are the listeners who support the station. You know, it's, in a way, it's kind of sad that so little of our modern age talks about and thinks about the magic that occurs with radio, because to some extent it still is a little bit. And in our case, the magic is the relationship that the people of the community have with us and how much they treasure WIL AM and FM and appreciate the two services. That's why they call 217-244-9455 during fund drives like this one and pledge their cash, what they find of something of value to us, to help turn it into something else of value, and that is the information that they derive here on WILL AM during Focus 580. And to help you along a little bit, if this wonderful conversation on mysticism and the great age in the 1920s isn't enough, if you aren't enthralled enough, I want to talk a little bit about something else that's magic, and that's pizza. And Jupiter's Pizza in downtown Champaign will send you a $10 gift certificate to encourage you to come on board at the $40 level or above to help support the programs here on WILL AM. If you have appreciated Focus 580 for a number of years and gotten some ideas for conversations or some really good actionable information, we want to encourage you to become part of what makes it all happen, and that's the involvement of our listeners. 217-244-9455 or online at willpledge.org.
All right. Thank you, Rita. We'll talk again at the end of the hour. Our guest, Gabriel Brownstein, the book is The Man from Beyond, and it's published by W.W. Norton. And, of course, if people wanted to call in here and be involved in the conversation, you can do that. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. The title of the book comes from the title of a silent movie that Houdini made called The Man from Beyond in 22. And I guess he made several of them.
Yes.
Have you seen The Man from Beyond?
You know, I have not seen it. I tried to see it and I haven't found it. It's not easy to find. I hope to see it someday. I've read a great deal about it. I've seen movie stills. You know, apparently Houdini's movies were not that good, but I would like to see them. The basic problem with Houdini as a movie star, well, there are several. One, he wasn't an actor. Two, he made up all his own stories. And three, his essential talent to do escape artist stuff on movies doesn't make sense, because anyone can do it. You know, with editing and splicing and props, you can do any kind of escape. So to have it part of a narrative movie,
It just didn't work.
It doesn't really work.
Yeah.
So.
On what other levels do you think that title operates?
Well, we haven't spoken about it. I mean, the novel has a heroine, a journalist who is covering the debate between Doyle and Houdini. She's covering it for a tabloid, and she is a sort of very modern young woman, a New Yorker. An educated woman, a professional woman, all these things, kind of new things in 1922. She's very young, and her brother has recently died. I think a lot of the spiritualism stuff in the early 20s was in a direct response to the horrors of World War One, and Conan Doyle's son died in World War One, and Molly's brother, Molly Goodman, is the heroine, also died there. And she has a very secret, passionate relationship with her dead brother. Not passionate in any sense other than the emotional connection with a dearly beloved dead relative. And she hides that from the world, as I think many people do. In other words, she's a sort of sophisticated modern person who in her heart of hearts has some magical thoughts. Joan Didion has written a lot about this now, about how, you know, you do think magically in relation to your, when people you love die. And so she, while she's covering all these stories and trying to behave rationally and skeptically, she privately thinks and prays magically to connect herself with her dead brother, who sort of looms over So Houdini and Doyle are sort of men from beyond, in the sense that they're just so out of place.
Yeah. And these events do indeed take place late-ish in the lives of both men when they are probably past their prime. Houdini only lives another 4 years after this, and I'm not sure how much longer Conan Doyle lives.
Longer than Houdini, but not so much longer. I mean, Doyle was still writing and still quite successful as a writer. He was an incredibly prolific man. I mean, he was writing these spiritualist tracts, diaries of his trips to America. He was coming up with new characters. There were new movies of his, he wasn't just writing home stuff.
He was irritated that that was the thing that most people knew him for because he felt he had written other things that were better and more serious. And it sort of, I think it sort of galled him the only thing people knew that they wanted to talk about that they were really excited about that he had done were the stories about Sherlock Holmes.
Well, the Professor Challenger stories were also big. The Lost World, the guy who goes to discover the dinosaurs in South America, a book called The Lost World was also big. He had other big hits. He liked his historical romances a lot. And they're not bad. They're pretty good. And people still read them. Sir Nigel, The White Company, but Sherlock Holmes was the biggest hit.
Yeah. We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. Someone who's listening this morning in Urbana on our line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I had read that one of the reasons for his intense interest in spiritualism was his deep love for his mother and the possibility of contacting her after her death through spiritualism.
Yes.
Could your reader comment on that, please?
That's Houdini that we were talking about.
Yeah, Houdini,
yes.
Indeed.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Call. Yeah. Thank you very much for the call. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Thank you.
He really did. They both had Doyle had this. His eldest son Kingsley had died, and Houdini did want to get in touch with his mother. He was very connected to his mother, deeply so, and he. There are still people who gather he promised that if he died and there was a beyond, he would come back and tell everyone, and there are people who still gather by his grave every year on his birthday, on Houdini's birthday, to find out if he's coming back. He hasn't come back yet, but he also was very interested in connecting with his mother, and there's a scene in my novel which is somewhat close to a scene in real life where the Doyles try to get him in touch with his mother, and Houdini is sort of noncommittal about it personally and then publicly denounces them.
And that apparently also really happened. There was
pretty close to it,
a seance. Lady Jean Doyle did spirit writing, so it was supposed to be the idea was the spirit got into her, and then she wrote what the spirit had to say. And apparently the Doyles believed that they had gotten in touch with Houdini's mother, and Houdini, for reasons that you explain and people can find out about if they look at the book, he didn't believe it for a minute, but he apparently didn't want to hurt their feelings and wasn't really all that upfront about it until they left the United States, and then he came out and said, look, I really don't think this was real. This was not my mother. And that, I think, also that was not good for the relationship between
Houdini
and the Doyles.
It was not good. A lot of the book parallels closely with stuff that happened. But then, I sort of draw in this other character, and then things take turns for far more extreme than they did in real life. Again, I wanted to make it. It's a fantasy. I felt when I was reading it, not like I was reading about celebrities, but I was reading about fantastical heroes. And I wanted to write a book that corresponded with reality, mostly on that dream level.
Yeah. Well, as you say, there are characters in the book that are based on real people, Doyle and Houdini, and this medium.
Marjorie.
And then there is the character that you create that helps to kind of tie them together, the young woman who's the newspaper reporter.
Right.
And It also strikes me that one of the things that this story is about is it's about media.
Yeah.
And I came across an anecdote that I thought was really interesting that, and I'm hoping that in fact it is true, that after Houdini died, his wife, Bess, was going through his stuff and came across some books on spiritualism and the supernatural. And she thought it would be nice to send them to Conan Doyle. And she wrote to him and offered to send the books. And Doyle himself apparently was kind of hesitant because he thought that at the end of his life, Houdini had had bad feelings about him, about Doyle. Yeah. And Bess apparently said, no, that was not true, and blamed most of the problems between the two men on the press.
Everybody.
I love that. Yeah, well, of course. Media is everything bad is, you know, it's our fault. But it did make me think about the fact that in some sense, the debate between the two men on their various attitudes and approaches to spirituality really was carried on in the press.
Yeah, and there was a difference between the personal connection and the public connection, but they. Mm-hmm. They were public men and wanted to be public men. It's really hard to imagine for me. I try to think of analogous contemporary people to Conan Doyle and Houdini who tried so hard to speak out on public issues. And you know, there are a lot of them. I mean, Bono's the most successful example. I mean, he's in a completely different league than either of those guys. But a lot of stars who want to become spokesmen for causes, they sort of try to cash their celebrity in on to make themselves public figures and maybe on larger causes than they can really speak to. I think that they were performing on a public stage, both of them, and I think there was a lot of confusion in the real lives of the men between themselves as friends, as people who would talk over things, and as public figures who would speak out on these issues before the world and debate each other before the world. I mean, they did write columns for newspapers, so for them to blame it on the media, I mean, they were the media in certain ways. So
there's an incident, and again I don't mean to undercut your creativity by pointing out again that there's something you write in the book that actually happened.
Oh, no.
But I think it's such a great story that I wanted to tell it and have you talk a little bit about it. And this is it when Conan Doyle was here in the United States, he gave lectures, and he was invited to speak to a group of magicians.
Yeah,
and talking about spiritualism, and no doubt a lot of these magicians were skeptics, as Houdini was. And Doyle said something. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to show you something.
Right.
Now, this is not this is not exactly spiritualism, but I'm going to show you something incredible. And he made this big setup. So then they turn out the lights. And he shows a movie, and suddenly what this group of magicians see on the screen in front of them are dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Cavorting dinosaurs, and they're just stunned. It's unbelievable, and it's incredible. Everybody just wowed by this, and it makes the papers, big splash in the media of the time. And then afterwards, Doyle sort of says, well, guys, what this is, it's a clip of a movie, a silent movie that was a movie adaptation of my book, The Lost World. You know, they're not real dinosaurs. It's a movie.
Yeah.
And which got me thinking about a number of things, including the idea that the book plays with this question of do we actually believe what we see? And and in what way do we, you know, if someone shows us a picture of a little girl with some fairies that quite clearly to our eyes today are paper cutouts, but people at the time, not only Conan Doyle, but a lot of people believed it. They said, this is incredible. Look, it's pictures of fairies. I mean, maybe that was at a time when we had a belief in films and photographs that now we know that you can't have that kind of a faith in them.
Anyway. I don't know if we still know that we can't have that kind of faith in them.
Hmm.
I mean,
we still pretty much believe what we see.
A lot of faith has been produced very recently very famously, and a lot of people have died over pictures that were shown by the Secretary of State at the United Nations that were supposed to be certain things that they were not.
I recall that. Yeah.
You know, and whether the Secretary of State believed, as Conan Doyle believed, that he was pulling everyone's leg, or whether he believed that they were true, I don't know. I don't want to get in trouble, but people do still believe pictures. You know, I think we still have a very confused relationship with technology. I think one thing that motivates someone to write historical fiction is to imagine, the beliefs of people who came before, and take them seriously, and try as much as possible to sympathize and understand. We often talk about back then people believed X. Back then people were more innocent. The idea that Conan Doyle was more innocent than you or I is I think a deeply misguided one. Conan Doyle was probably smarter than either one of us, and a man of immense talents. A doctor. He did work he did go and solve murder cases and show the people were wrongly convicted. He had incredible breadth of talent, and I really see him as a tragic figure, and because his beliefs were so well-intentioned and so crazily egomaniacal, you know, that he could save the entire world. He was really smart, and he fooled a whole room full of magicians, which is really not an easy thing to do, you know? And I think one of the things I wanted to do, or tried to do in writing the book, was to draw myself into the mind of that kind of belief. In the novel, at least my character, Conan Doyle, is interested in Einstein, which was, you know, competing in the pages of Scientific American with the mediums, if you can imagine that. And you're not exactly understanding what relativity meant, as I certainly don't exactly pretend to understand exactly what it means. But imagining relative perspectives, and that the perspective from the beyond would be different from the perspective on Earth. I don't know. I kind of fell in love with Conan Doyle writing the book. Yeah. And I think that his confusion between technology and belief should be one that's you know, not quickly dismissed. I mean, I don't know that we should respect it. But.
Well, it strikes me here that these two individuals, they're archetypes that we still have, that maybe we embody, that we're still having this debate. We acknowledge the fact that they're both were intelligent men, but that one was a deep skeptic and one was a true believer. And that we're still arguing about an awful lot of things from those two perspectives. And a lot of things we still haven't made up our mind about.
Right.
And that we still have true believers and we still have deep skeptics, and they still argue strongly and sometimes violently and sometimes bitterly about things without always coming to a solid conclusion either way.
Yeah. And I think that ego plays a huge role. I think that for Houdini, the part of it was just competition. I mean, he wasn't motivated, I think, all by good. I think he wanted to show that they weren't as good at playing tricks as he was. And for Doyle, good though he was, I think that a lot of it was this idea that he could save everybody, you know? And skeptic is a funny word, because Houdini really thought he knew the truth. it's different. He didn't doubt. He knew.
Yeah. Something that I think that is true, and also is interesting in the dynamic between the two men, is that Doyle apparently thought, as I guess some other people at the time thought, that maybe some of what Houdini did was not a trick. Now, and this was probably aided and abetted by the fact that Houdini, like any good magician, would not reveal how he did things.
Right.
So he did incredible things, and he did them live there in front of people.
Right.
They watched him walk through walls and stuff like this, do things that seemed to be impossible. And and apparently, there were people at the time who thought maybe there was something supernatural about Houdini and what he did, and that it was not simply a matter of his skill and athleticism and his ability as an illusionist, that there was something unusual, not natural, going on. And Doyle apparently thought maybe that was the case, and thought that maybe indeed that Houdini was doing it and without really even knowing it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's hard to know what everyone thought, but Doyle seems to have thought that Houdini was drawing on powers from the beyond and maybe not being so straightforward with everyone, or maybe not knowing it, or maybe, you know, again, what they said publicly, what they said privately, it's hard to know. But he does seem to have thought that, yes, he drew on powers from beyond, and he does seem to have thought that, yes, he was tricking everybody. One thing that's really interesting in this is just how Houdini did these things. And something I sort of got interested in, the techniques for these complex things, and the rigorous training that Houdini put himself through. And how rigorously trained his body was. Houdini thought of himself as a scientist of escape, the only honest practitioner of magic, which is an interesting idea. He did things that you just... there's one I read that it was a young man, he hung upside down. I mean, you know, he had to train every single muscle in his body. And as a young man, he hung upside down and picked up needles with his eyelids. I don't know what that means. I don't know how one does that.
How exactly do you do that? Yeah.
I have no idea. To train his esophagus, he put a raw potato on a string and swallowed it and regurgitated it and swallowed it and regurgitated it until he could do the same trick with a billiard ball. He could, you know, palm things without moving a muscle in his hand, without moving a muscle on the top of his hand. You know, he had distinct control over different muscles in his body. It's shocking, the amount of development that he had, and the amount of technique. Interesting to me, and especially in the sense that, like, the past was innocent. No, there's nothing innocent about Houdini at all. He was incredibly sophisticated. I got interested in the book. I got interested when I found a book that Houdini had written. I didn't know that Houdini wrote. And I found this book called A Magician Among the Spirits. And it had a picture on the frontispiece of Houdini and Doyle, and I knew nothing about them. And it had this incredible voice, this maniacal voice of Houdini. Whether he wrote it with a ghostwriter or not, it has his mania. And, you know, like many geniuses, he was blessed with mania. The book is, I think, out of print, and it's sometimes difficult to read. But it has this incredible energy and passion. And that was what initially drew me into the story, the sort of incredible wildness of Houdini's force of character and the power that lay in there.
We've talked a lot about the two men, and they are fascinating individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But just in the couple of minutes we have left, I want to come back to Molly. Because she is, in a sense, the stand-in for us, in a way, because she's the only really sort of normal person. She's a regular person, you know, just like we are. We are. We're not, we're not Doyle or Houdini. We're just sort of regular folks trying to sort out some of the same issues, I guess. And she is the she is, in a sense, the last voice that you hear in the story, really.
She's like you say, I mean that while these issues are wild and wacky and unreal, they're obviously important to everybody. What happens when you die? You know, we don't know, and I imagine everyone, you know, worries and thinks. And Molly is certainly a stand-in for me to a certain degree, she's sort of, for me, where the emotional heart of the book lies. Because while she wants to look at these people as clowns and as just objects of her work, she's drawn in and finds they are asking questions that she's interested in, whether she admits it or not. And she does go to a séance in the end. And she does have a revelation at the end, though it's not exactly the revelation she expects, and she leaves the séance kind of confused. And she decides that the actual, you know, bells ringing and objects flying through the air are not the point of the séance, and that she is in no position to decide what's true and what's not true. And I think the drama of the story is in large part the drama of Molly discovering herself. And the action and the murder and the mystery that surround Houdini and Doyle in my book are things that drive her imagination and change her relationship with her family and her in her romantic life and in her imaginative life.
Well, we are going to have to stop.
Okay.
Because we've used our time.
Okay.
All of this and more can be found in The Man from Beyond. It's a new novel by our guest, Gabriel Brownstein. It's published by W.W. Norton. Gabriel Brownstein teaches at St. John's University in Queens and makes his home in Brooklyn. And Mr. Brownstein, thanks very much for talking
with us. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Well, we did too.
Okay.
Well, our program here, Focus 580, in fact, everything we do, is made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, Gallery of Imaginative Jewelry and Gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Focus is also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. And, of course, a very, very important source of support for this radio program and this radio station, listeners, folks like you folks who are out there listening to my voice come out of that box on the other end or in your car or wherever it is that you're listening. If you're a supporter, we thank you. If not, now is the time to give us a call. Go online, make a pledge, help keep this radio station strong. 244-9455 is the number to call. You can go to willpledge.org and do it that way. Whatever you like. Jack Brighton is in the studio here with me now. He's our guy who's responsible for our web effort, sometimes host Focus 580.
Right, and the podcast, which we haven't really mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
So if you use the podcast, we appreciate your support even more because, it's going to add up some costs, actually, for bandwidth, et cetera, and the time and effort that goes into it. If you listen to the show, you know what we do, and every once in a while we have to come to you to ask for your support, and that's what we're doing right now. We value your contributions on the air and also to support the station financially, so that's what this is all about right now. We ask you to go to the telephone right now and call 217-244-9455 with your pledge. You can also go online to willpledge.org and make a pledge online there. And we hope to hear from the phones in Pledge Central with Rita Schulte is our membership director with the phones in Pledge Central. There's one ringing now. How are we doing on the pizza thing, et cetera, Rita?
Well, so far, we were hoping we could hear from about 15 people, and we have five people supporting Focus 580 today, and we want to say thank you to those and encourage you, if you have been listening and enjoying this portion of the program, to call in with your contribution of $40 or more, and we will send you a gift certificate for $10 toward a Jupiter's Pizza. Jupiter's Pizza is in downtown Champaign. We'd like to encourage you to take them up on their offer. They believe in the quality of this radio station, as I'm sure you do as well, as a loyal listener. 217-244-9455. Now, Jack, we were trying to get to about $92,000 by the end of this evening, and currently our tote board said that we have about $76,000 raised so far during our fund drive. Now, we'd like to remind everybody that the goals that we set aren't really all that arbitrary. This is what it takes to make the programs happen here on WILL. Your dollars really do turn into programming. And since this is something that you find valuable, we are encouraging you during this week to help us keep it coming your way with your contributions. 217-244-9455. $10 a month can go a long way here on WILL.
Absolutely. And we really can't do it without you. We simply could not exist without the support of our audience. We know that 1 in 10 of our listeners supports the station. If we could increase that to 2 in 10, just add a few more people to the list of the Friends of WILL, it would make a tremendous difference to the future of the station and the service. So please do your part to help us keep it going. 217-244-9455 with your pledge.
Well, now we must pass control over to the staff of the afternoon magazine. There'll be news, sports, weather, other things throughout the afternoon. And, you know, here on Focus 580, also on the afternoon magazine, we like to create opportunities for people to get answers to problems. And on the show today in the 1 o'clock hour, you can do that if the problem has to do with your computer. Celeste Quinn is the host of the show, and computers and you today, right?
That's right. A problem-solving program coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine. Also, an opportunity to do some troubleshooting. Our guest this afternoon will be Greg Klein, science and technology reporter for the News Gazette. It's our monthly Computers and You discussion, a topic we take up once a month on the third Thursday of the month. Let's turn our attention now to the Chicago Board of Trade, where December wheat is trading at 330 and a half, that up 2 3/4. March, 344 and 3/4, up 3. December corn, 201 and a half, down 1/4. March, 214 and a quarter, down 1/4. May corn, 222 and a half, unchanged. December, 247 and a quarter, unchanged. November soybeans, 584, that down 5 1/4. January, 596 and a quarter, down 5 1/2. March, 604 and a half, down 5. December meal, 170.70, that down 150. December oil, 20.